Welcome to this Pump Court Chambers podcast. A very good summer to you all. I'm delighted to announce that on air with me today is Professor David Hodson, OBE, KC. Professor Hodson will be well known to the listeners of this podcast. He is the co-founder of the International Family Law Group. Professor Hodson is, of course, globally regarded as a leading, highly experienced family law dispute resolution specialist, especially involving cases with an international or complex element. Not only is David a qualified solicitor in England, of course, as we know, he is a mediator and a family law arbitrator, a member of the Chartered Institute of Arbitrators. He is a deputy district judge sitting at the CFC and also now in Devon. He is, I think not many people might know this possibly, but he is also an Australian solicitor, a visiting professor at the University of Law, and an honorary professor at the University of Leicester. Professor Hodson, thank you so much for joining the Pump Court Chamber.
Jennifer, absolutely delighted.
Well, I'm delighted to see you, and thank you so much for giving up your time to talk to us on this very important topic, probably one of the hottest topics of the year, if I may say so.
Yes.
When it comes to family law and particularly financial remedies. If I could begin by asking you this question, which is actually premised by a statement about the Matrimonial Causes Act of 1973. The MCA 1973 is now 50 years old. The Law Commission recently launched a review of the laws on financial provision after divorce or the dissolution of civil partnerships that is now very much underway. In your view, are there indeed issues with the current law which require reform?
Jennifer, thank you very much. Thank you to Pump Court Chambers for inviting me. As you rightly say, this is probably one of the important topics of the year. But will it result in change in the law next year? No. Will it result in change in the law this decade? Quite possibly not. By the time Parliament, even presuming it embraces the Law Commission proposals, if we get any with any enthusiasm, and we know the UK Parliament doesn't rather like dealing with family law reform, we're probably going to be looking possibly 2030 before it's in. So the first thing to say to all practitioners, don't worry about your case at the Central Family Court on Tuesday of next week. None of this will matter. However, it is a wonderful opportunity for the solicitors and barristers profession undertaking specialist financial remedy work, specialist family law work, to have a say in what may well be a change in the law for the next decade and onwards. This law has been around for 50 years, as you rightly say, 1973. If we do have any statutory reform, we can only presume that will be around for another 50 years or so. So here we are till the end of the century, if we look ourselves in dramatic terms. And why has it been undertaken? Simply because, as you rightly say, we have had no major statutory reform of the law since 1973. And yet, in that 50 years, how much has changed? Women in the workplace, men actually at the school gate, let's look in terms of gender elements there, the greater range of financial holdings, a different expectation of marriage by the younger generation. The younger generation has now worked its way through. Different expectation, again, I come back to the role of women dependency and so much. So there has been a huge societal change, and the judges have done their best to keep pace. And we have in England, more than any other country around the world, in my belief, judge-made law more than any other country. And that has served us in many ways brilliantly. The judges have worked their socks off in many ways to adapt and adjust. The most classic of those was White, year 2000. We had really got out of kilter. Small money cases, men were doing badly. They were losing their house for their lifetime. Bigger money cases, women were losing out because there was a sort of cap on what they could claim. White was brilliant. It gave us equality. It gave us a sharing. It was brilliant. And for many years after that, we had a lot of certainty in many ways. But in the last 10 years, I think a good number of us would say that we have become more uncertain. We have become unclear. And that, as we know, leads to a lack of settlement. It leads to increased costs. We have, over the past 5-7 years, perhaps no more than that, Jennifer, a scandalous list of cases where the higher court judges have condemned the outcomes, a disproportionate costs. And we have had an uncertainty about a number of other areas. And I'll happily go through those maybe. But I think it's time has come to have a review. The review might mean that we have no reform, but we need a review. Any modern legislation, any modern constitution, any modern society must surely every half a century review what is happening to such a crucial part of the personal lives of, let's be frank, so many of us in this day and age.
Thank you, David. And what in broad terms will the Law Commission be looking at in terms of whether there is scope for reform?
They've got to say to themselves, is the law if such that it warrants the wholesale reform process? It's a two-stage process. They've got a scoping until September 2024. We'll come on to that. And then if they say there should be reform, they'll then have a longer reform process that will lead to Parliament, et cetera, et cetera. They've got to say, do we need reform? Is our law so uncertain that it is leading to more litigation? Is our law so uncertain that people, you and I, frankly, in days, day by day, doing our work, advising on financial remedy cases, are able to say with some confidence, this is likely to be the outcome? Is this a general element, or are there just a few of the aspects around the margins, and that the law is generally straightforward, but it's the margins that are the worry? Is the element of discretion too uncertain? And certainly we have had in the last 5 or 7 years, two judges in particular, without personalising it, in the High Court and the Court of Appeal, who have really been quite a significant difference of views. Mr Justice Mostyn, I won't say a fanboy, but I'm really support where he has come from in many of his cases, has done his best in his perception to produce certainty, to produce absolute clarity, sometimes at the risk of hard cases, etc. How much should you take into account assets more than 1 year after separation, Jennifer, one of the instances where he's gone down that road. And yet we've got in the High Court, in the Court of Appeal, Lord Justice Moylan, another brilliant financial remedies judge, who I think could be said has a greater inclination towards keeping discretion. It came to a head in the case Head and Hart, a case called Hart, H-A-R-T, where he took Nick Mostyn's views, and he said, this is where we would follow that approach, but then in other cases, etc. And Hart is one of the difficult cases we've all got to get to grips with. And that symbolised to me, and many of us, the uncertainty. How much do we want more certainty? Even though that certainty, Jennifer, may mean that some of the cases produce harsh outcomes. And there is the continual problem. The benefit of the discretion that we've got, broad discretion on an individual fact, mean that we shouldn't have harsh outcomes. The more certainty, the greater the harsh outcomes, the hard outcomes, as we would call it. And that's what the Law Commission's got to balance up. Because undoubtedly, the reform will pull back from the unfettered discretion we have at the moment. Whatever we do have, and we can talk about the various models of reform in a few minutes, whatever we do have will pull back from that. So where are some of the problems? You say, well, let's look at the matrimonial home. Urban myth number one, the matrimonial home is always divided equally. No, it's not. We've got a load of judgments which say you look at provenance, particularly the length there. What about premarital? Well, the law is that if they live together before marriage, as if they were married, we look at that premarital assets as part of the sharing. But I suspect most people don't know that law. And in any event, if they did, there may be a difference. And I'm sure you've litigated it many times, you and colleagues in your chamber. Was that five-year period before marriage, premarital cohabitation, as if they were married? Uncertainty. What are the guidelines? Ditto at the end. If I could wave a magic wand, I would make everyone apply to the court to sort out their finances within a year of separation. The bane of all our lives is the client who comes to us and said, well, I separated 5 years ago. My spouse and I have had a good relationship, etc. I've changed my finances. He oblique, she has changed their finances, etc. And you've then got to work out, how do we divide it up? Another key element is matrimonialization, a verb that probably should never appear in any Oxford English dictionary, etc. But it's when is a non-marital asset become marital? And that is often the key element of it, of many of our cases. Oh, it's now a marital asset, and therefore it's in the 50-50 sharing pot. No, it's stayed. These are uncertain elements, and it seems to me that because of this uncertainty, we have too much litigation, too few cases are settling quickly at FDR, too many cases are going to FDR when they should be settled by specialist solicitors, barristers well before the FDR process in itself. And there is the Law Commission's dilemma. How much do we say this really does need changing, or how much do we say, right, Just let the judges get on with it. They've done an okay job in the last 50 years. Okay, guys, off to you for another 50 years.
Yes. Well, David, thank you for raising that, because I think one of the key areas that the Law Commission will be looking at is whether there should be a clear set of underpinning principles set in statute, which, well, certainly my understanding is not to completely prevent judges from exercising discretionary powers, but it would be seen as a fetter.
And for myself, that's where I would be wanting to go, Jennifer. I'd be saying the unfettered discretion has served us well, but can't serve us hereafter so well. We need to fetter it. And the question then is, how do you fetter? Do you fetter by presumptions, by principles, or do you fetter by saying certain categories of assets will definitely be dealt with in this way? And we are, more again than any other country, a needs-based driven jurisdiction. How much do we give the courts the opportunity to make whatever order they want on the basis of needs? Should the needs be generated by the marriage? Marriage-generated disadvantage is how sometimes judges refer to it. Or should it be generally that's what's happened in life? If during a period of marriage, one person falls immensely unwell, can't work, etc., how much should marriage be viewed as a safety net, a help to allow them if a divorce then occurs? And that's a debate we haven't had in the last 50 years. Baroness Hell would have said, and she did say this in a couple of her cases, it should be relationship generated. Other judges have said, well, no, it's or Justice Thorpe from years ago said, well, it's not going to pick up all the ills that occur during a marriage, but it's got to pick up some of them. So we haven't had that debate. And it may well be that the emerging generation, 20s and 30s, if I can call that, may have a different view from those in their 50s and 60s who maybe have a different perspective on it. And that's what we need to hear. We need the Law Commission to go to the public and say to them, what do you want? What do you think should happen? Because at the moment, I suggest we don't really know.
Yes. And I think, interestingly, if I could just broaden out the conversation.
Please.
One of the certainly points which the Law Commission have picked up in their terms of reference is whether or not courts should have wider powers to make orders for children over the age of 18. And interestingly, I see that conduct might also be on the docket. Conduct as a solicitor might be the
Well, that's a worry. The fact that they can actually consider conduct, I think none of us practicing, or very few of us practicing, would want to see conduct widened in any way. Indeed, I had a meeting with the Law Commission a couple of weeks ago, and I said quite explicitly to them, I'm worried about addbacks. Because ad backs were a relatively recent invention. This is if somebody has spent some money, should it be brought back onto the balance sheet to be divided 50-50? And the judges, in what I consider to be pure public policy, have said ad back is effectively like conduct. It's got to be reckless, and et cetera, et cetera. And that, in my opinion, is out of step with the public. They simply say, well, hang on, they've engaged in a lot, they've spent a lot of money. Maybe not recklessly, but it's gone. Why can't it be brought back? So conduct, yes, it will be there, but I'd like to think addbacks will be brought back and taken out of the conduct category. Will we have lump sums for children over 18? I doubt that will be the way forward. I think it's quite interesting. I'm sure the Law Commission had a say in the government giving them their brief. They won't be looking at cohabitation. They won't be looking at the Child Support Agency. They won't be dealing with that. They won't be looking at enforcement of financial orders primarily, because they did their own paper on it, and a very good paper it was, about 3 or 4 years ago, has transformed the way we now deal with enforcement of financial orders. Won't deal with Part 3, won't deal with Schedule 1. So it's relatively limited. It really is Section 25. It is what is the criteria and categories? We've got the powers. I don't think most of us are unhappy with the powers we've got. It's how we use those powers, and that's the essence of it.
And do you know, David, whether the current reform will be looking at marital agreements? Because I understand that was covered in a 2014 report by the Law Commission.
They say it won't. They say it shouldn't, because they say we've already done a report on it, but it was quite a few years ago. And it seems to me incomprehensible that they will produce a reform proposal that doesn't take account of marital agreements. Why? In my humble opinion, because we have seen a move in society towards private autonomy. We see people saying, let's be frank, family lawyers are not the most beloved profession of all. We rank pretty low down there. And many of them say, we want our own agreement. We see them doing that at a time of divorce. They say, OK, we've had advice, but this is the agreement we want. Those of us in mediation or doing arbitration see the coming together. Not in all cases, of course not. But I think it's inconceivable that they will not at the same time, at the very least say, and at the same time as we're changing the law, we've got to have a marital agreement law. There are people in the House of Lords who would say we should bring that in now. I don't think we can. I think it would be completely wrong to look at the Law Commission proposals and then actually be trapped into some sort of marital agreement law based on that. But I certainly feel that we should have it as part and parcel of that. I also worry about the gender element of it. Sweeping generalizations, and Jennifer, you're right to pick me up in a few moments if I go too far. But I think I worry mostly about women entering into it. Not always, of course. We have a case of James Holman, I think, where he identified the man was really badly disadvantaged. So certainly not across the board. But I think, and Barrett and Brenda Hale drew attention to this in the Radmacher case, the worry that there is the great pressure on women to enter into disadvantageous agreements. And solicitors and barristers around the country will have had instances where they've said to the client, this is not a good deal, don't sign it. And then they come back a few weeks later and say, I've signed it, or we're instructed. So I do worry about marital agreements. We know the vast majority of countries around the world have them. Pop across the English Channel and most of the continental European countries will have them without independent legal advice. And one of the issues for the marital agreement is how much should you have independent legal advice before entering into it? Radmacher says there's got to be the opportunity. Really? Should we go further than that? But I'm absolutely certain that marital agreements is a key component. As we look around the world, it's a key component of these sorts of provision. And the more we introduce a harder law, a more fettered law, the more people are going to say, well, actually, we'd like to opt into our own arrangement. It's not part of our English culture, but our English culture is changing.
Yes. And David, if I may raise this, probably one of the more controversial areas for reform, which is currently being looked at by the Law Commission. Should there be a potential maximum period for spousal?
Thank you for asking that question.
Well,
There is,
I think you envisaged I might be asking
yes,
this.
I thought you would. And understandably so. I worry about this going into Parliament. We saw this in 1996 when there was some legislation went through. There is a huge concern by a number in Parliament to create a maximum period for a spousal maintenance order. And I do worry that those who are promoting it are of two ilk. One, they are likely to be the paying parties or representing or close to a number of paying parties. Or secondly, they may have a perception that women are able to go out into the workplace after a divorce unscarred, I'm sure it's probably a strong word, but unaffected by having not worked for 5, 7, 8 years. That sort of tradition is still a prevalent one across many parts of English culture, and therefore they can say, go slot straight back in. There are some in those circumstances who can, but they are the rarity. I worry hugely. We saw in Scotland that they introduced a law about 25 years ago, and it was perceived by many as very disadvantageous to the traditional stay-at-home wife who has simply given up a career by agreement. And sometimes you yourself will have seen it a number of times in court. You ask and say, well, to the husband, did you agree to your wife giving up her career to look after the children? You were earning well, etc. You could afford it. Yes, that's what we agreed. Why is it then that within a matter of years, a couple of years or so, that one should be able to go straight back and become self-sufficient to a good level? So I'm not in favour of that, but there will be a strong body, and the closer we get to Parliament, the stronger that lobby will become, in my worrying assessment.
Yes. And David, you mentioned Scotland. Could I bring in the other countries
Yes.
which apply? Obviously, the Commonwealth system being Australia, New Zealand, as you know, Singapore, Malaysia, these countries. But just focusing perhaps on Australia, New Zealand first, do they have term maintenance? I mean, a particular maximum period on spousal PPs?
No, but we are the country in the world which has probably more spousal maintenance orders than any other. It will be relatively rare in Australia. It'll be tucked up as part of the capital settlement. It will be relatively rare. Looking across the channel, it's very rare. I think in France, it continues as long as the divorce is continuing. Spousal maintenance is not a very lively creature on the worldwide family law stage at the moment. So, yes, the move is towards term orders, or indeed no orders whatsoever. And let's be frank, in the vast majority of modest asset cases going through the family court, there's barely enough money to support the children to a good level. There's certainly little. These are the bigger money cases where we're talking about substantial spousal maintenance to any meaningful level.
Yes. And speaking more generally, might the models in Australia, for example, or perhaps in the United States, looking more broadly across the pond, might their family law models help us in considering reform of financial provision in England and Wales?
Undoubtedly, and the Law Society, sorry, the Law Commission have said that they are looking, and they're already in touch with a number of jurisdictions around the world. The Law Commission of New Zealand has recently done a review of its financial remedy law, and they're swapping notes. Maybe they're swapping reports. Who knows? Of course, it's primarily the common law, not just Commonwealth, but primarily the common law world, because they come from a discretionary basis rather than the European. I think they'll look at Australia in relation to marital agreements. They've had them for a number of years, but they have strong preconditions. Both parties have got to have independent legal advice before a marital agreement will uphold, and then it will be binding. It will be binding. I have an anxiety that I don't think our English Parliament and our English society is willing to go down a road that says if we want to enter into a marriage and enter into a marital agreement, we both must see a lawyer. I think we are a much more delawyering society, using a ghastly expression. I just don't think it will take off. So we've got to say, what are the preconditions we want for a marital agreement to make sure there's safety for both genders? I think New Zealand is going to be the country where there's going to be a lot of reflection. A number of years ago, I think it was back in the mid-1990s, they codified their law. And they said, basically, what is our law? Let's put it into statute. And it hasn't worked that well. It can produce harsh outcomes. But I think this is a serious contender for where we may go. And the Law Commission may say, well, let's actually fix into statute law what is our existing case law. And I'd have thought we could do that without undue difficulty. I mean, premarital, when does the marital home become matrimonialized, etc., if it's a premarital, post-separation, etc. I would have thought we could do that, and that will therefore produce more certainty. Yes. It will produce some harsh outcomes, and there would still be some fettered discretion. But then we would have to say, in what circumstances? And New Zealand's got some categories. France has got equitable distribution. A number of countries around the world have quite rightly said, we're going to claw back from the certainty, a small realm of uncertainty. And that's, I think, the model where I would be wanting to go. I think that's the crucial model. The other element I definitely want to bring in here is digitalization. I've tried, others have tried, to convert our present financial provision law onto some digital flowchart, etc. It's almost impossible. Defies belief that in the year 2030, if that's, Jennifer, when actually we have the new law, and I suspect it will be about that time, we won't have the opportunity for the vast majority of cases to have an app on our phone or on our wrist, or who knows, it's probably on our forehead by then, whereby we can input the basic data of the finances. And by then, it will all, of course, be digitalized and no doubt easily recordable, input it. And the outcome will then use AI or whatever to say, under the law, the likely outcome is X. It may be a narrow range. It may be X to Y, where that is 5% of the total assets, etc. It may then need legal advice from you and I and our respective chambers and firms, etc., to say, OK, it's this end or that. But it wouldn't be the broad range. And it's the broad range that it causes people to litigate because it's worthwhile. So I think one of the reasons I'm also supporting this reform is that we can have a law that we can convert to a digital process. And that's happening in so many countries around the world. And then I think last of all, in this sort of global reflection, we've got to look at Europe, continental Europe, which has a community of partnership approach. And we've been going in that direction as we were. But do we want to go that far? Do we want to simply say, whatever the assets were on the date of the marriage, whatever the assets were on the date of the separation, add them up, divide by two, that's your lot. If you've got a bit of a slight variation, maybe spousal maintenance, if you're lucky. I think that works very unfairly on the spouse who has given up a lot for the marriage in financial terms. One of the brilliant things about White is that the House of Lords, then now Supreme Court, said each spouse makes an equal deemed contribution to the marriage, even if they contribute in different ways. And it seems to me that is a pulling back and is saying that the financial contribution is far more important. Everyone is equal, but some are more equal than others. And that's where I worry about going down the European Community of Property direction. So I haven't yet come to a view. This is the nature of the debate that you and I are having, and thank you for your chambers helping lead on this. But I think I'm coming to a form of codification with a carefully worded discretion.
Yes. And David, if you don't mind me asking you this, I know you recently gave evidence. I don't know whether that's the right word, or perhaps you spoke.
It was a debate that was set up in the House of Lords, outside the chamber, of course. There were two peers that took part. I'm sure I'm not giving away because it was public. Mr. Justice Mohsin took part. He made it very clear that he couldn't speak freely and fully, but he would do so in a few weeks' time when he was no longer sitting. We wait to hear more on that. There was a strong view from those some of the speakers that we should have the marital agreement law brought in now. There was a strong view that spousal maintenance should be limited to a period of time. Nick Mohsin was saying, as he has said quite publicly on a number of occasions, we need to have more fettered, more discretion, more clarity and certainty. There were some very good contributions from the floor, from the solicitors, barristers profession, and a number of peers turned up, some of whom had had good experience as a family law. Some of had had unhappy experience from family law, but still made their own contribution. It was really a sort of curtain raiser to the discussions for the Law Commission. And I think it's curious. I'm not really sure what is happening with the Law Commission proposals. I know on the record they are doing a scoping report. Yes. And they scope, by which means they say, this is exactly where we're going, or this is what we're going to look at. It seems to me that they're engaging in a quasi-consultation over this period. I and a number of other lawyers have spoken with them. I think they've reached out to a number of the stakeholder organisations who in any event have worried. So it seems to me that without being a consultation, they are informally consulting, and rightly so. And I think that's great. So I think they will have, there's a team of about four or five there working on this project. Great, great people, because I've dealt with them on previous consultations from the Law Commission. They're going to work their socks off over the next 12 months to produce a paper. And I think it will ultimately say, yes, we do need to take this further forward, or no, with a few provisos, etc., back to the judges.
Well, Professor Nicholas Hopkins, who is the Law Commissioner for Property, Family and Trust Law, I think when the Law Commission announced this review, he said, and I'm quoting from an article, he said the laws governing financial provision on divorce or the ending of a civil partnership should be as fair and simple as possible, minimizing the risk of conflict, uncertainty or financial strain. And so my hunch is that when the scoping paper is published in September 24 or thereabouts, we will be looking at recommendations for reform. There will be recommendations for reform. But I think the tricky question will be where we draw the line in terms of how the discretion that is currently being exercised by judges will be drawn. I mean, that's got to be a political dialogue. Informed by wider consultation.
I agree. It's interesting, when the Children Act came into force in 1991, it was the 1989 Act. And so the judges knew the new direction of travel given to them by Parliament. And so between 1989 and I think it was October 1991 when it came into force, judges changed direction. Of course, they were under the old law, but they knew where the new law was going. I just wonder, because I agree with you, Jennifer, I just wonder if the Law Commission comes out in a scoping paper and makes a few comments and recommendations, etc., whether the High Court, Court of Appeal Judiciary will say, well, we've seen what's been written after a consultation by some eminent people, including, of course, Nicholas Hopkins, over the last 12 months or so. And therefore, in this particular case, we think the outcome should be this on that basis. In other words, they will adapt, they will move, move with the wind, maybe. They will say, we have heard how society is talking to us through the Law Commission, just as we have tried to adapt the law over the last 20 years or so in judge-made law, and therefore we will bring it in. And that is a real possibility. And if that were to happen, then arguably, Jennifer, we would not need to have go through the parliamentary process. Not least because the judges may be aware that the likelihood of the parliamentary process is limited.
Well, September 24 is 12 months away. And of course, once that scoping paper is published, there will be a period of full consultation with a variety of stakeholders and members of the public, followed by potentially draft legislation. I don't imagine that timescale being less than 2 to 3 years.
Minimum. Minimum.
So in the meantime, we'll have to sit tight and ensure that our ground is to the air. Sorry, the ground.
But I do wonder, we're now all aware this is taking place. The sort of, I won't call it a Damocles dagger hanging over our head in sort of court nine of the Central Family Court or whatever. But never, we do know this is happening. Will we be seeing more certainty coming out of the higher court decisions, maybe to forestall any strong recommendations? Who knows? But I would have thought we're likely to go more certain than less certain over the next 12 months. But knowing this is happening in the background.
And David, in the final 2 minutes or so, for those who might wish to do more reading or more research, they want to find out more about what, you know, the Law Commission might be looking at. Could you recommend any particular resources or any websites or?
Well, the Law Commission website itself, and they have set out there very clearly, I think it's a paper, I think I've probably got it here, the terms of reference. It's interesting to see, this is what we're not doing. And then there's the terms of criteria. Tediously boring, clause 1.10, we will specifically consider, but not limited to considering, and then there's 7 points. They'll follow certain assumptions, 1.11, there, sorry to be tediously boring, quoting paragraph numbers on this generalised reviewer, and then 1.13, we will not be considering, and then there's 8 paragraphs there, which we've broadly touched on already. So I think that's where it will be. I do know there's a number of articles that are in the process of being written. I'm not sure now they will necessarily help. I think it's all eyes are directed to the Law Commission HQ and the purple smoke that no doubt will emanate on the 1st of September 2024 or whenever. I think it's helpful to have a discussion within the profession because this discussion will help us. But yes. The Law Commission are very aware this is not a lawyer-led reform. The lawyers will help the discussions, but this is a matter of going to the public. What does the public think should be the criteria, the way in which we resolve financial matters on divorce? And we lawyers have got a contribution to make, but we're certainly not going to be anything like the final answer.
If I may, David, I'll mention two particular articles which I found hugely illuminating. The first is an article I found written by you, in fact.
Oh, dear.
sometime before the Law Commission decided to launch this reform, where you touched upon, in some detail, some of the areas now which the Law Commission are looking into, and it's on the familylaw.co.uk website. And it's titled, it's Family Law LexisNexis website, and it's in relation to possible reform of the Section 25 criteria, which I found to be.
Thank you. And if anyone wants it, email me at the International Family Law Group, and I'll send you the original text.
Absolutely. And secondly, I thought I'd mention this as well. It's an article by His Honour Judge Hess, of course. Yeah. So actually very important reading in relation
at
to
the coalface. Yeah,
absolutely. And his thoughts in relation to some reflections, certainly on the recent announcement by the Law Commission, which which again was enormously helpful, and it's on the Financial Remedies Journal website. But I particularly found your analysis of the models in other countries very instructive.
Thank you.
Because we know that the Law Commission are looking at other yes. models across the world. And I think that might provide us with an insight as to what is on the horizon.
Thank you. I think so. Thank you for that. Yes, it's interesting. Edward Hess and Robert Peel, who's just taken over from Nick Mawson, I think their view is that we've got enough certainty, clarity, trust the judges. I don't want to speak for them. I can't speak for them. But I think that would be their probable view. So it's interesting. So there we are, different elements of the profession, solicitors, barristers, judiciary. That's why it's ripe for this sort of debate. And again, thank you to Pump Court Chambers for leading on this.
Well, David, thank you very much indeed for giving up your valuable time this afternoon. To all our listeners, we hope you have enjoyed this podcast. I certainly found it hugely thought-provoking. So thank you, Professor David Hodson.
Thank you very much indeed, Jennifer.
Thank you.